And so you have to have an idea, and I'll tell you what it is. But so this was, you know, I don't think anyone will complain if I say, you know, wouldn't it be great to discuss of everything I showed you, and we would have 10 times more events. So you would get 1,000 events in several years instead of 100 events in several years. And there is actually a logic to this. You can actually, given the diffuse flux, and let's assume you can do this in a Euclidean universe if you want. So just think of as the universe as a box that's actually the volume of the universe, if you think of it as a big ball, the visible universe, is 10 to the 67 cubic centimeter. That always baffled me. That's, I think, to some extent, it must be a convention. But that when people do energy estimates or so, that's the volume of the universe. So you fill it with sources. You can do this with correct cosmology or not. Just do it. And then you can ask, you know how many neutrinos these sources emit, because we know the total flux. Then you can ask, when will you see the nearest source? You see what the problem is? And to see the nearest source, you need about between 500 and 1,000 events. And so what you want to is accumulate it, because you don't want one neutrino from the nearest source to prove it at 5 sigma, you want many. So you want an experiment that produces 1,000 neutrinos in a short time, not 100 in 5 years. So you look puzzled.
So you said, do you see the problem? I said, I didn't see the problem.
You didn't see the problem. Well, think of a box that you fill with sources that send neutrinos at you. And take blazars, so you know what their density is in the universe. And you assume they produce, in fact, I took blazars when I gave you this answer. So you know the density in the box of the sources. You know how many they emit total, that's the diffuse flux. Then you can calculate how many you get from the nearest source. The nearest source is a volume that contains one source. And the result of this calculation is that you need about, in fact, the answer is you need 700 events to see the nearest source. So you can, but obviously this is now irrelevant, because in the handout you will eventually get, I'll leave my slides and this handout here, this calculation is performed. It's not interesting enough. Of course, you get different answers if you assume different sources, and if you, because then the density is different of the sources. You get different answers if you assume they have some interesting cosmology. But this is like a key answer. And so if you build a 10 kilometer cube detector, you're kind of guaranteed to begin to see sources. This is further helped by the fact that if you build a kilometer cube detector, it's not as difficult to get to 0.2, 0.1 degree resolution. They will have 0.1 degree resolution. And that's the resolution of these gamma ray telescopes we have been talking about, like MAGIC and Veritas. And you should be able to do not multi-messenger astronomy, but astronomy by yourself. So How do you do it? Let me first show you what we know about the optics of the eyes. As I told you, when we started this project, we knew absolutely nothing about the optics of the eyes. And this is what we found, actually. We found we built this R&D experiment, but this R&D experiment was too small to really measure the optics of the eyes over a kilometer length. That we only know by building IceQ. And so this is the absorption length of blue light in ice. Remember, to normalize this, the water in the Super K detector is here, at this level. And so everywhere, this ice is better than the ice in Super K, the transparency, except for this region here. You say, well, what are these ups and downs? Well, remember ice, or don't remember, ice is made up of compacted snow. Like here, this is snow that fell like 60,000 years ago, and now is compacted by all the snow that fell on top of it. And so in Antarctica, there is a wind that goes around the pole, just like at the North Pole, there is a wind like that too. And during ice ages, there are dry deserts in South America, and this wind picks up a little bit more dust during this period than when, you know, not during ice ages. And so it's the weather, basically, that makes good or bad snow. So it mix, if you mix in a little bit of dust, then your ice is not as pure. It's like the Super K water. There's no magic to this. Your absorption length just increases with the purity. There's nothing else. So the pure. And so we actually measure this. I will not go in how we measure this, but I can tell you, if you look at ice cores that are taken at Vostok stations, like this is thousands of miles away, and you look at the transparency of these cores, you find exactly the same thing. In fact, it's not the transparency, the absorption length we compare, it's the scattering length. Because the dust has a scattering length. And you see, this scattering length is on the order, you cannot see that here, but that's on the order of 50 meters, not 100 meters, in the clear ice, and in fact less in the not so clear ice. So I already mentioned this. So this optics is not that simple, because it means it's good to detect photons 300 meters away, but they will scatter. And so when you reconstruct your Cherenkov light pool to reconstruct the Cherenkov cone, you have to take that into account. So for these very high energy events, it takes like a normal cluster of 1,000 computers. It takes half a day to reconstruct the event. And it's because you have to propagate all these photons through this ice that scatters when they interact with dust. And so it's very important to know very well what the density of dust is. And so this is a measurement we did of the density of dust. And what you basically do is you lower a device in the ice that shoots light into the ice and detects the reflected light. And that measures the amount of dust. If the ice were infinitely pure, the light disappears, nothing comes back. So you measure the amount that comes back, and that you do this measurement before we put in the photomultipliers in like, I have forgotten, in an hour. You go up and down and make a measurement like this. And this is actually out of a paper we wrote.
Wouldn't most of the reflected light be just from the index of a fraction difference between the water and the ice itself? Like if you were,
No. In fact, that's something I was not. In fact, our limitation at the moment is not the optics. Our limitation is understanding the optics of the ice that's refrozen in the hole. And we know what happens, actually. You know, when you drill a hole, you melt the ice, you put a lot of oxygen in it. So this hole is full of bubbles. And so where did these bubbles go? And nobody was able to guess that. Everybody thought that they went to the bottom of the PMT, which is not a big deal. It actually helps. It collects light. What they do is they go in a thin column right in the middle of the hole. And the rest of the hole becomes totally clear again, and they sit in this small column in the middle. And so specifying the optics of this is now our leading systematic effect. It's not this. But I want to point out, for instance, look at this. It's not just the weather. This peak here is less than a centimeter in length. And it's actually a volcano that went off 74,000 years ago. And there was a big controversy in the field. This was called the Toba eruption. And it was seen by the geologists in the geological layers. And it was not found in the ice cores. But we found it, so actually our measurements are better now than the ice core measurements. So now, what do you do with this? Well, we place typically the thing you think of naively is actually true. How far can you space your strings? You space them one absorption length. And so if you really want to detect high-energy photons, you can push it a bit and space them more, a little bit more than absorption length. So at the bottom of the detector, that's 250 meters. So you space them by 250 meters. We space them by 125 meters. Well, why? Well, we had hints that the absorption length was very long, but we couldn't prove it. With the Amanda, because in Amanda the strings were 40 meters apart. So you do optical measurements over 40 meters, not over a kilometer. And so this was a long debate, and we put them at 125 meters, kind of as a compromise. Of course, it was the wrong guess. We should have put them at 250 meters, but we know now. But the problem is that to calibrate a detector, you have to be able to shoot the light from the LEDs that are sitting in the modules from one string to the next. And if you space them too far and your LEDs, the absorption length is such that your LED light doesn't make it to the next string, you have no detector. You cannot calibrate it. So we had to be conservative. I told you, you know, you don't waste $270 million. So, but now we are optimizing, and the right answer, so you see that size cube, and then you build detectors around it where you put strings on larger and larger spacings and kind of try to optimize. And the answer is somewhere between 240 and 300, not really 360 meters. And so that's the key. Now you take the same number of optical modules and distribute them over a 10 times larger volume. And so it costs the same, not 10 times as much. And that's a reasonable thing to ask for. There is no free lunch, however. You give something up. What you give up is the threshold of your experiment. And so that's where the problem becomes a little bit more tricky. You want to, the threshold of ice cube now is 100 GeV. You don't want it to go above, say, 10 TeV, because then you don't see galactic sources anymore. Galactic sources don't have this spectacular high-energy neutrinos that we are now seeing from extragalactic sources. They cut off. And our sensitivity to galactic sources is somewhere around 40 TeV. So that's the detector we are trying to build.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I mean, why do you use Ice Cube as the corner of the new detector instead of like building
cement? It doesn't matter. We could put it around it, but the runway where the planes land is there. But it doesn't. In fact, NSF has already told us that we can drill in the runway. It doesn't matter, right? It's once the detector is deployed, the runway is still there. There's no problem. And so this is what this experiment looks like. So it begins to look like Russian dolls, right? But what we are also going to do is we probably deploy more strings. We'll probably make them 80 PMTs per string between 1.3 and 2.7 kilometers. This is the edge where the bubbles come in. And of course, once the bubbles come in, you have no detector anymore. So, and 2.7 is still 250 meters from the bedrock. So it's okay. There was a problem with this. When we start this experiment, the question was whether the bottom of the ice is attached to the bedrock. And this detector is sitting in a glacier, which moves between 10 and 11 meters per year. And so the worry is that if you deploy them too deep, the shear could actually eventually destroy your detector. But we now know that first lakes were discovered under the South Pole, and then it was discovered that these lakes were connected by rivers. And in fact, now we know that the whole glacier is running on some hydraulic network of lakes and rivers. And so we actually measure the temperature. The temperature, if you measure it from the top to the bottom and then extrapolate, it's actually at 0°C within the error. I said we need more detectors. Here is what they are doing in the Mediterranean. In the Mediterranean, they have built a detector called Antares, which is about the same size as our Amanda detector. And so it shows that, it's a demo for building a real detector like this. And the reason we built the detector in ice is because we thought that it's much simpler to put photomultipliers a mile deep in ice than to put them in water. And of course, history has proven this correct. We are 10 years ahead of these people. But they have managed to prove that they can build a stable detector in the Mediterranean at 2.5 kilometers. This detector is a deployment, the first deployment. They are going to build an ice cube type detector off the southern tip of Italy, of the heel of the boot of Italy. Catania is the headquarters. And so this is how they do this. You see, this is a whole string of digital optical modules that's wound up in this metal ball. And so you lower this metal ball to the bottom, open it up, and then by buoyancy, this string comes up and it's deployed. You connect it, then you have a junction box that's connected by fiber optic transmission to the shore. And so you connect each of these strings to that box, and then you have a detector. So this is under construction, and hopefully, you know, they can work year round. It's not like us. We have only December and January. So hopefully they will deploy a detector pretty soon. There was this historic battle that went on for 2 decades, whether ice is better than water or the other way around. And that's a very complicated question, actually. And that's now being answered by doing the experiments. And it kind of, ice works very different from water. But in the end, it doesn't matter. It's a question we couldn't have answered before having actually done it and discovered and detected neutrinos. In ice, the transparency is not as good. And so you cannot space the strings in water by more than 100 meters. So that's okay. That means they will have a lower threshold than what we are building. So for galactic sources, this will be presumably the better detector. Of course, it's in the northern hemisphere. So for the muons, the well-reconstructed muons, they will see the opposite sky from us. And so that's a big advantage, too. We'll have a complete picture of the sky. In fact, we are already, you know, in this business, it's not like CMS and Atlas. We analyze data together. We throw our, even with Amanda, with Antares, although it's small, it can look into the galactic center. And so to do some of these measurements to look for sources in the galactic center, we combine our data and write papers together. So,
how are they dealing with the illegal fishermen problem?
Well, yeah, that I mentioned. That was their first problem. I don't know. I really don't know. I do. It seems to me like that's what they're worried about. By having to maintain an exposed fiber optic network on the bottom of the Mediterranean. They don't seem to be worried about the survival of the optical modules. So that's the future. I'm going to, before I go to my next topic, you saw this slide before. And these are the type of things I really should have talked about and didn't. I always show this slide. This is to stay out of trouble with my colleagues who think I should have mentioned this. We actually see neutrinos from 10 GeV to 10,000 TeV. At the bottom end of this detector, I mostly talk to you what we did at the upper end. At the bottom end, we actually measure atmospheric oscillations. This, you know, still baffles me that we can do this. We can detect supernova, and I'll just mention the idea. It's very simple. You know, supernova emit MeV neutrinos. I just told you that the threshold is 10 GeV, but if a supernova goes off, for about 10 seconds, there are so many anti-electron neutrinos interacting in the detector that the complete light level goes up. Every module detects light. And so you just look for a moment when for a certain time, all your modules in unison detect light. And so from 10 kiloparsec, a supernova like 87A is a 25 sigma effect. And in fact, by looking how often one versus two Cherenkov photons hit your photomultipliers, you can actually measure the energy of the neutrinos. So, you know, we just need a supernova. There are 3 per century, and 87A is 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago. So it'll be tomorrow. We search for dark matter. We search for everything, actually. Dark matter search is very serious. We got our first funding for looking for dark matter. And for certain forms of dark matter, we actually have the world best limit, not xenon. Where are you? And what we do is you just, it's a very simple and old idea. Dark matter, you know, gets trapped wherever there is a gravitational well. So the sun has trapped dark matter since it exists over billions of years. And so when the dark matter accumulates, it falls into the center of the sun. And if there's enough of it, it starts to annihilate. And if it annihilates, it annihilates in neutrinos. It annihilates in other things, but the other things never get out of the center of the sun, but the neutrinos do. And so it's perfectly calculable. You know, you give me a WIMP mass and a WIMP cross-section, and I can tell you how many neutrinos we should see and of what energy. And so I actually challenge you. I think it's the only dark matter measurements. If you saw something, nobody would be able to challenge that you've seen dark matter. There's no other way to get this. The only astrophysics assumption that goes into this is how many protons there are in the sun. And we know that. So there is no unknown astrophysics, and you know, it cannot be fake. You know, Dharma may have discovered dark matter, but all it does is start discussions, right? And I predict when someone else discovered it, it will be the same thing, except this. But we don't see anything. So when we got, you know, a typical 100 GeV WIMP with the Amanda detector, we could detect it as dark matter in 1 year. And of course, what we have been doing for the last 20, almost 30, is put better and better limits on the cross-section. That's all. Yeah. So we are looking for magnetic monopoles. Haven't found those either. We search for EV mass terra neutrinos. They don't exist. We do
cost. Can you say that definitely? Is like categorically disprove this?
I'm allergic to sterile neutrinos. You know, it's kind of, it's a serious question because I'm allergic to it because it's like people constantly tell me in the last 20 years that they have evidence for supersymmetry. And people have been telling me for 20 years that they have evidence for sterile neutrinos. And I don't believe either one. And so the problem with the sterile neutrinos is, you know, it's, you have heard these talks, right? I can give it myself, of all these indications. And of the Los Alamos experiment that has 3 sigma evidence. Well, this is again a statistics lesson. 3 sigma 20 years ago is not 3 sigma today. because they optimized the energy measurement on the sample in which they claim to find the oscillations. That's with 2 parameters. That's infinite number of trials. And I will tell, so, and, you know, maybe, actually, there should be sterile neutrinos because now, if you look from it from the theoretical point of view, it's very difficult to think of any new neutrino physics. You know, we know there is new neutrino physics. It's very difficult to tell of any new neutrino physics other than sterile neutrinos. Because the standard model, you know, connects the CKM matrix, the leptons, to the neutrinos. And the CKM matrix, we know there is no room with high precision. We know they have standard model interactions. So the only you cannot really play with new neutrino interactions. The only way is to stick in sterile neutrinos, EV or not. But this is not it. In fact, I'll come back to it in a minute. We have an air shower array on top of the experiment that was built for calibration, but has been doing fantastic cosmic ray physics, actually, and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not going to go through this list. I'm just going to show you some examples of the results, and then all my colleagues will be happy, including the ones that live in Edmonton. Here is the slide said 1.5 million atmospheric neutrinos. That's what we have collected. Remember, we collect an atmospheric neutrino every 4 minutes now. So this is the worst neutrino detector with the highest statistics. And you play one against the other. And you can do oscillations. Nobody had predicted this. So how do you oscillations? You produce neutrinos all over the world. So you measure the zenith angle they arrive. And you're actually doing neutrino physics through the Earth on different baselines, not just from Chicago to Homestead. You choose your baseline, and you just measure the energy and the angle, and you're doing oscillations, and you have matter effects. Now, we have made this a little bit easier by building what's called deep core. At some point, we didn't spend our under 72 million. We actually came in under budget, and that was spent on building this detector with another grant from Sweden. And so what we did, instead of putting detectors, new strings outside and make a bigger detector, you put more strings inside. And then you have more photocathode coverage over a smaller volume of ice. But this is still an enormous volume, right? I always am tempted to show super K on this, but it's kind of insulting. So it's still much bigger. And once you have this thing, it's very easy to reject your background because, you know, you measure an event here and then you look back into Ice Cube and see if there was any activity there. And if we can actually shield this detector using Ice Cube as a veto. So there is no atmospheric neutrino flux going through the atmospheric muon flux going through this detector. So this is, of course, the most expensive veto ever built, but it works. And so let me show you a result. This is the oscillations nu mu to nu tau, you know, in the atmospheric neutrino flux, half of your nu mu's end up as nu tau's. And so this is the oscillation probability. And so the activity, the neutrino activity you normally hear about is happening here. We are measuring oscillations at 10 times higher energy here. And we can anchor it, not only, this is much easier to measure. It's a huge dip. And we can anchor it to high energy where neutrinos do not oscillate. And so we are in this game. In fact, this was our first measurement. And you see, we immediately measured this dip as a function of L over E. And in fact, this is our latest measurement. And you see, these are the various experiments. This is IceCube published in black. And this is IceCube about to be published. So what we did is, I mean, we did, you have to imagine, you know, you may say, well, they knew the answer. No, these are two independent, totally independent blind experiments. We had no idea when we opened the box what would come out. And they're using different reconstruction techniques. And so we want to make sure, and they don't quite agree. So it gives, I mean, we at least have a feeling for what our systematic errors are. And so, and you see, we are not quite competitive. T2K does better, but we are not finished yet. So we are in this business. We have a measurement for new tau appearance for which I couldn't find a slide, but we are going to do this much, much better. In fact, I didn't mention when we want, in order to build the next generation detector, the 10 times bigger detector, we are going to deploy strings with all kind of new type of modules. And we will put these strings inside deep core and use them at the same time to build a better oscillation detector while we test the new modules, the new type of modules. I have a slide missing. Okay. The EV sterile neutrino, well, I can draw it. What happened to oscillations when you have an EV sterile neutrino? Remember, we measure the, this is a beam coming through the Earth. So what happens is you have the three neutrinos oscillating through the Earth, but if there is a sterile neutrino present, the electron neutrino spend part of its time as a sterile neutrino. And that changes the matter effects. Because the matter effect is because the electron neutrino, unlike the two others, can interact with the electrons in the Earth. But if it spent part of its time as sterile, you switch the matter effects on and off. And that actually not just affects your oscillation pattern, it actually makes a resonance. And so if you look, you know, the oscillation probability as a function of energy, you know, you come out of this big dip. And if there are sterile neutrinos, you go, of course, this is like a TeV, right? This is 20 GeV here, something like that. What happens is, for a 1 EV mass, all your muon neutrinos in the atmospheric beam disappear and then come up again. This is impossible to miss. And it's there or not there, and it's not there. So if you change the mass of the neutrino, of the sterile neutrino, then this dip just moves. So it's at 3 TeV, for all your new mu's have to disappear and become new tau's mostly. And so we looked for this dip, you know, unbiased, totally blind analysis. We only had to use a year of data. We are going to come out at the next NUFAC meeting with 7 years of data, with much better limits. But you see, this is actually the quality of the data. And you totally distort the angular distribution and flux if you put that resonance in. Now, it's not by looking at this that you decide, oh, there's no dip anywhere. This is washed out by our energy resolution. You have to be careful. In fact, the most important thing is you see this resonance as a very clear distortion of the angular distribution. That's just not there. And if you convert this to limits, here are the limits. This is the LSND cigar. So that's where the 1EV neutrino was supposed to live at the time. And these are our exclusion limits compared to Minos at the time. This was published in PRL. We are now going to do this. Soon you will see this for 7 years of data. And what actually happened after that is they said, but they reanalyzed everything, and there is still some possibility, like at a few EV. But actually, if you look at that claim, so the cigar moved outside our boundaries, but if you look at that claim, it cannot explain all the anomalies. It can, for instance, not explain the Mini-Boon anomaly. And so, anyway, we'll rule it out next.
Yeah. Ice cube.
No, these are the old.
This is
published in Physical Review letters a couple of years ago. 2 years ago, I think.
Was it the red spot in there?
What?
What's the red spot there?
That's the best fit.
The dot?
Yeah.
The best of what?
The best fit.
Yeah, of
all the data. If there were a sterile neutrino, that's where it would live, most likely. Just no meaning, you know. It's a minimum in nothing. That's exactly what it is. It's a minimum in nothing. Okay. So what am I going to do next? I should show you this picture. I am not doing this alone, as you may have guessed. Okay, so that's now I have, how much time do I have left? 3/4. I promise you all the time I would explain shockwave acceleration to you. I could do that.
That's right.
Is anyone? But I didn't hear that.
Is that a threat?
Yes. Especially that I promise, I already tell you, I don't really understand it. But that doesn't stop me from explaining it. So I could alternatively tell you about galactic sources. Who wants to hear about shockwaves? Who wants to hear about galactic sources? Again. Shockwaves, galactic sources. I'll tell you quickly about galactic sources, then do shockwaves. Galactic sources. Okay. Let me first tell you, I alluded to this already, what I saw, what you see in the data. When we look at for sources in the sky, we look, you know, I already told you, we look at this 10,000 direction in the sky and look whether there is an excess of neutrinos and never find anything. And so we also have a table of our preferred sources. And we look at these sources, and you can ask, what's the most, which source has the best probability to be an excess over the background? And this is this source, Milagro 1908. It is a source in the galactic plane. And Hawke sees this source in 100 TV gamma rays. And the probability, actually, is 0.0032. That's not bad, actually. But if you...
Explain, this is the probability of what? It looks rather low.
That it's an excess.
Oh, that's
that it's right. A real source. That's the probability that is consistent with the background. It isn't. And it's another way to say there's a bump in the sky, right? And so this is the type of thing we are looking at. This has shown up all the time, but we haven't really been able to claim it. If you look at the sky in that direction, there it is. And it actually suggests that we are not looking for it in the right place. And so if you actually put it in the right place, the probability would even go down. So. Oh, that's what you saw this morning. I actually don't know why this is there. These are the blazars from Fermi. I have no idea why they are on this map. Anyway, yeah. So when you calculate the flux you expect for gamma rays from the gamma ray flux, you convert it into a neutrino flux. You have seen me do this many times. You can make a prediction. You can put it in our simulation, run the detector for 5 years, and look at what comes out, and there it is. In fact, there is a bigger effect there. That's another Milagro / Hawk source. And so you can see we are looking for 3 to 4 events in 5 years. And that's actually close to 5 sigma discovery. If it isn't, you go on for another 5 years. So we should find these sources. The problem is when we find it, we still don't know what it is. But you know, if you look at this map now, remember what you saw this morning, 90 neutrinos in 150 days. This calibrates the September 22, the Texas source discovery. Okay, so that's galactic sources. I could spend the rest of my time telling you how we calculate this flux. We have to see these. There's no other way, but we haven't. So that's you will hear about this imminently when we finish our analysis with the Hawk data. So now somewhere I have to have, it's here, are the lectures on. If you listen carefully to me and you understand what I'm saying, you will understand this picture. Okay. So what I'm going to do is work through an example. So we are going to consider, eventually, we are going to consider a supernova remnant in our galaxy. Remember I showed a picture yesterday of one where you saw this pulsar, and then you saw this solar mass of energy pushing the debris of a star into the interstellar medium. And then you saw these filaments that looked like a solar flare. And I said, here there are high magnetic fields, and here you have acceleration of particles. And so what shocks do is you release this solar mass of energy from the collapse of the stars, and it takes like 5 to 10% of this energy and converts it into acceleration of particles. And that's exactly what you need to explain the galactic cosmic rays. It's all theory, but it's nice theory. So what happened? I tried to start it. Okay. This is the original idea of Fermi, how accelerators are, how cosmic rays are accelerated. So you think of a particle, and the particle will gain energy when it collides with a large cloud. this is probably they interact magnetically, but you can even forget about this. You can think of something moving with high velocity into a big thing that's moving at you. And after the collision happened, this particle will gain energy. Don't worry what this has to do. I'll eventually get there, right, to what I'm trying to explain. So let's calculate how much energy it gains. Our frame is the observer frame. It's this particle moving and the cloud moving this way. So the energy, initial energy, is a half mv squared, where v is this v. So now we transform this to rest. Let's put a cloud at rest. So you have to add u to the velocity. So in the frame where the cloud is at rest, the energy is a half m plus u squared. So what happens now? The particle comes in, interacts, and reverses direction. So it scatters elastically, reverses direction. So in the cloud frame, the particle energy becomes a half m minus v minus u. It reverses velocity square. Now in our frame, where the real world is, we transform back. And now I have to go the other way. Instead of adding u, I subtract u. And so the final energy in our frame is this. So how much energy did it gain? It gains this minus the original, an half mv square, divided by a half mv square. And if you work this out, you do a little bit of algebra, and it's u over v plus u square over v square. And I've now put v equals c because that's the cosmic ray. So it moves at the speed of light. I guess this part is clear. This may be the last thing that's clear. So now you can do this relativistically, and you have to do this not on a line, but integrating over angles. And I will show you these slides, how you do it correctly, but it doesn't matter. I'm going to stick to the simple examples. So Fermi invented this, but then he realized that it didn't work. And so, never mind here, this is what we just derived. And if you want to get to high energy, this must happen repeatedly. So you must bounce with a lot of clouds minus you, that moving at you. And then you will gain this many times, and that's how you can accelerate particles. The problem is, the cosmic ray move randomly in the galaxy, so you meet as many clouds going towards you than clouds going away from you. And then these are the good collisions where you raise your energy. Here you lose it. So the correct answer is u over is this multiplied by the good encounters. And this is just the Doppler effect. U plus V over V is the number of encounters this way. This is the rain on the windshield when you're driving into it, right? The Doppler effect. So for this case, where the clouds are subtracting from your energy, it's just the same. You write this over and reverse the sign of U. And then you do the algebra and you realize that this term disappears. But u over c is a small number already. If the effect now, if you take into account that you have good and bad encounters, now the effect just becomes quadratic. And this is an extremely small number, so this doesn't work. What it means is it takes too long time to get in a realistic time scale to high energy in our galaxy. So this doesn't work. Is this clear? Yeah, this should be clear too, right? So what do you need? It's clear what you need. you need something where all encounters are good. And you say that's not possible. Well, it is possible. Yeah.
If you have the particle that's speeding up from this, then if you do this sequentially, each time your V, if you're building up, your V is getting bigger. And I think at one point, there's an approximation where you take them to be...
No, you never get out of this approximation.
Okay.
These clouds are really small velocities compared to... In fact, I don't even know what these clouds are.
Well, no, V.
You know. I know. Yeah, the V is close to the speed of light, right?
Oh, I see.
V is about C, and it's much larger than U. That's the approximation. You never go out of that approximation. Any other questions? Okay. This is going well so far. So. This is now, we come to the example of the supernova explosion. So what happens is you have, it's the picture I showed yesterday, you have the debris of a star that collapsed, left behind a neutron star, and you have this stuff being pushed out with one solar mass of energy into the interstellar medium. This shock here moves actually, so what's the shock here? The shock is, it's very important. The galaxy is not empty. There is one hydrogen per cubic centimeter. And so the shock actually is running into material that's already there. So it's like a snowplow. It sweeps up material as it expands. It actually typically goes like at a tenth of the speed of light. These things are, you know, are big if you look at them 300 years after the star explodes. And so what you have here is like a snowplow that has accumulated particles here. And this is the interstellar medium, one hydrogen per cubic centimeter. And this is the high density material that's blown away by the star. So the density of material here is very large compared to here, where it's only one per cubic centimeter. But it's important that it's not empty. If you would think of the galaxy as something empty, this wouldn't work. And the analogy is the following. You can do that. I have done this experiment myself. You take a plate and you let a faucet run over it, and you can set up a shock. And the shock, you know, the water runs, but then you can arrange it so that the friction, it's an equilibrium, the friction returns water, and that friction, you can set up a stable shock there. And you see, if the plate has no friction, this would just run out. And that's the same effect here. So that are all the ingredients. And so rho one, this is called downstream, is larger than rho two, which is the one per cubic centimeter. And of course, then the velocities are reversed. If this is the higher density, this is the smaller velocity. You know, it's moving, the particles are moving in this high density leftover of the star material. And so this is the low velocity, this is the high velocity, because you have to conserve particles. So rho one times V one has to be rho two times V two. And that's what you call, that's the shock. In fact, that's the filaments you were looking at in the supernova remnant picture yesterday. So, okay with this? Doing well. Now here is the key. This system has only good encounters. Now you have to remember, this is the shock. Now the shock has become this orange thing. And you are going to accelerate particles. Now you have to realize these particles are not sitting there. You cannot think of this, it wouldn't work. You cannot think of particles that are, you know, pushed out from the collapse of the star and then others that are sitting there. These particles are high energy particles. They move in the micro Gauss field of the galaxy. So what a particle that you want to accelerate typically does is it wanders around. That's its gyro radius. If its gyro radius is much bigger, you are not going to accelerate it. It's much smaller, you're not going to accelerate it. So these are the particles that are going to be accelerated. And they wander around, and they can cross this shock many times. So that system where particles gyrate around this shock, each time it crosses the shock, it gets a good encounter, whether it goes this way or that way. You say that's not possible, just watch. So here we are in our own frame, and there's the shock there, and it's moving at a velocity u from left to right. So in the rest frame of the shock, I'm going to take the example V1 over V2 is V1 is smaller than V2. And the easiest way to do this, this has something, it depends on what the system is. But for a system like a snowplow and gyrating particles, I'm not going to derive this. This is like 1/4. But for the explanation, it doesn't matter what it is, but it's actually simpler if you use a value like 1/4. But that's a realistic value, actually, for reasons I will never explain. This is a plasma with a magnetic field. And
Can you remind me which V1 and V2, which is upstream, which is downstream?
V left is downstream, so I'll go back. Okay? So this has become the shock. So the snowplow is moving at u in this direction. And so the right is V2, and the left is V1, which is the high density and the low velocity material inside the supernova remnant. So let's transform this. So let's call, let's go to the frame where the shock is at rest. And let's call V2 there u, and then V1 is 1/4 u. Right? So now the shock is at rest. And V1, I've put up a system where V1 is 1/4 of V2. So let's go to the frame where the particles upstream are at rest. To go there, I have the particles upstream have a velocity u. So to transform the frame where they are at rest, I have to go minus u this way. And then here, it's u minus u. So this particle now is at rest, and the particles at the other end have have 3/4 u. They have minus u plus 1/4 u, which is 3/4 u. I've just transformed frame, right? So this is minus 1/4 u, plus 1/4 u, minus u. So this is 3/4 u. So from the point of view of upstream, when a particle comes this way, it crosses the shock, it hits the shock at 3/4 u. It's a good encounter. Let's now look from the other point direction. Let's put the particles at rest here. Then I must boost 1/4 u in this direction. The shock is moving at one quarter U. So V2 becomes U minus one quarter U. No, minus U plus one quarter U. That's three quarter U in this direction. And you see, from when you are, no matter where, how you cross, you always have a good encounter of three quarters U. Now, you probably feel like I've lifted your pocket, but this is correct.
I feel like the opposite, the fact that they were in opposite directions critical to what was a better person?
No, no, no. If the particle comes from this side, the shock, it hits the shock, like in the good collisions of my previous transparency. If it's here, it hits the shock as well, three quarter U. So each time it crosses again, it only does good encounters. That's the key. And it's really not that difficult. Intuitively, you can understand it, right? Here I'm a particle, and what's happening, there a supernova exploded, I get pushed in the back. But here, there is all this stuff out there, one per cubic centimeter, and it's pushing me in the other direction. And so the particle is sitting like between two walls that are approaching, and the energy goes up. It's another way of looking at it. And yeah, any other questions? This is the key. You know, I have this picture hanging on my blackboard in Madison, and I look at it at least once a day, convincing myself that I really understand this. It's true. Come visit my office sometime. It's hanging there. The problem with this is that, well, shocks exist. This is a famous shock. This is the shock set up by the sun. So this is the termination shock of the solar wind. This is the solar wind runs into the galaxy. And in fact, we know this shock exists because the two Voyager spacecrafts went to it and measured it. This is actually one of the most beautiful experiments done. It took a long time. It took longer than Ice Cube. But they did it. They went through outside the solar system. And in fact, we see cosmic rays being accelerated specifically at that shock. They're called anomalous cosmic rays. And they have been identified. So this works. Of course, I have another slide. I said, if you understand it, then the pictures will become clear. So you see, this is the shock. The ball crosses many times, and it gets hit favorably in each direction. And so this is... Okay, now there is a critical word here. If you actually calculated what I just said, this would really not work very well. You won't get to very high energy. To make this work, you have to imagine, and this is where, you know, this is the simple picture. Now to make this work and actually accelerate galactic cosmic rays to a real interesting energy, like reaching the knee in the spectrum, where we think these are all galactic cosmic rays, then you have to imagine things. So if the particle comes back, not just because there is friction, there is matter out there, but behind this snowplow, there is all kind of turbulence, and that helps the particle to return, cross the shock again, and then go out again. So there are these tooth fairies that you invent, which are basically names and words. If you take this literally, what I just showed you, it doesn't work. You don't get to 10 to the 15 electron volts. And we know that the cosmic rays are galactic to probably well beyond that, to 10 to the 18 electron volts. So does this give you a power? And the answer is yes. Remember, you're supposed to get e to the minus 2. And this is the derivation. It are all good encounters. So now the linear term is back. It's no longer u over c squared. It's u over c in each collision. So energy gain per encounter with the shock is u over c to the k. So each time you go through the shock, it's u over c. Then you gain again u over c. So delta E over E is u over c to the power k, where k is how many times you cross the shock. The number of particles that get accelerated depends on the probability that you cause the shock. If the probability is high that the particle returns, then it's easier to get to high energy. So the change in the number of particles is the probability that it returns to the same k power. And so, you know, particles, if they go to that side and they don't come back on the magnetic turbulence or what, they're lost. And that's the end of their energy. But if they return, then they can go and gain u over c again. So that's the critical quantity, the number of times you return. So if you return k times, that's p to the k, where p is the probability of one return, and the energy you gain is u over c to the k. So that's how the shock works. Now what I can do is I'm going to divide these two. So delta n over n is minus beta over p to the k delta e over e. So now I just divided the top two equations. So now I have, I'm going to integrate this. The shock starts with n0 particles. And n is the number of particles I end up with accelerated. So I integrate, so delta n over n from n0 to n, where n is the number after k crossings, is minus beta p to the k, e0 to e. E is the energy reached off by n particles after k crossings over e. And now I integrate. And this is delta E over E. It's E over E zero. And this is log N over N zero. That means that N, the particles that were accelerated K times, is the number you start with times their energy E over the original energy to the power gamma. And gamma is this quantity, is beta over p to the k. So the NDE, I take the derivative, is minus 1 minus gamma, where gamma is this quantity. And so you see I get a power. Now, if beta over p is 1, then this is minus 2. So it is 1. Because p is u over c. You know that beta is u over c. P is u over c as well. Because the probability that you return is, if you have, you know, you the shock is moving, the particle has crossed, and the probability to swept up again by the shock and return, the faster the shock moves at you, the more likely it is. A fast shock, big U, is going to sweep up more particles in front, and all these particles will return and go to higher energy.
Doesn't that mean that the earlier statement you made that U is going to always be much smaller than V has?
No, it still is always much smaller.
So if U is smaller than C, how can it sweep up a particle moving away, but it doesn't influence?
This eventually stops.
Okay.
And it actually stops before this approximation breaks down. You know, the shock is always, has always a much lower velocity. Like, I said, a tenth of the speed of light is what these shocks move at. So that means that P is proportional to U over C2, and this is minus 1, and here is the e to the minus 2. Voila. Yes?
Is there P over beta in the third line?
Pardon?
In the third line, is there? It should be P over beta to the K power.
Here. You mean the sign? Yeah. The sign should...
No, the fraction should be the other way.
You divide the first line by the second line.
Oh, did I invert it?
If it's one, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. The answer is right, no matter. Really, I inverted it, delta n over m? Yeah, it looks like it. But it's still, the result is the same. That's the problem when you know the answer. Thank you. I have shown these slides to so many people. I finally end up in the right place. So now you know why shock acceleration is e to the minus 2. And so this is how, you know, you transform gravitational energy into acceleration of particles. And it doesn't have to work really well. You know, with supernova remnants, you less than 10% will allow you to explain. If you, you know, you go to the calculation, you have 3 supernova per 100 years, and they go off in the galaxy, and 10% goes into acceleration, you get a cosmic ray spectrum. Now, you say, how is this possible? Because this is where it becomes real cosmic ray physics. Eventually, of course, you're going to fill the galaxy with high-energy particles, but these particles only stay in the galaxy for a certain time. You know, they gyrate, and eventually they get lost. They typically spend the high-energy galactic cosmic rays typically spend 1 million years in our galaxy. So what these supernova remnants are doing is filling up the bottle so that the flux is constant. Why the flux is constant, I actually don't know. I think we don't live long enough to be sure that the flux is constant, but okay, that's how it works. So I'm going to leave the slides here, and I hope the rest of the math is correct. But here is, if you want to go to these calculations, here are the angular integrations you have to do. And this is integral number 2. As you will, I think you can follow this until I think the algebra is clear. If you look at the slides, the important thing is the algebra is actually easy once you understand what's going on. It's the concept that's hard, not the algebra here or the integrations. Now I come back, and then I'm finished, to your question, you know, when does this break down? And it breaks down at a well-specific time. I mean, you can guess. It has nothing to do with how large U gets with respect to C. U is constant, actually. It just keeps moving. But what happens is that eventually this... You know, obviously, you put a finite amount of matter into it, rho 1. And when this shock wave expands, the density of both the snowplow and what's inside of it becomes lower and lower. And eventually, this density comes similar to the one hydrogen per cubic centimeter. And once the density kind of is diluted in the galaxy, then this mechanism stops working. And so it stops working when the interstellar medium has swept up this rho 1 of material. And you can happen, when this happens, your cycle of good encounters stops. And you can again look at the calculations in the, and this is the answer. It stops, the maximum energy is at, and you see this is the Hillis formula. This is the size of the accelerator, U times T, right? T is the time. And then you ask, when does this become when does the density become similar to the interstellar medium? And that gives you T, and that you put that in here. So this is the Hillis formula, which was just dimensional analysis with the U over C in front. And the U over C is the 5-10% you need. So this is actually beautiful. If you do the calculation, it you get to 10 to the 14 or so. So if you go back at the spectrum, you don't really cover the part that every picture you ever see says galactic and extragalactic. But then there are these, you evoke these tooth fairies, right? And then you may get there. That's it. You now understand shockwave acceleration. Yes?
I still understand the picture of the softball zooming at the heads of the two girls staring in shock and levitating.
Oh. Well, the little ball, you drop the big and the little ball. And so it's like first order Fermi. You know what happened? The big ball kind of sits on the table and bounces, but the little one shoots away.
Okay.
Okay? Yeah, you have to understand the pictures, then you have understood it.
So the girls represent question mark?
I took this from the web. I don't know where I took this. But I thought, you know, I saw this on the web on the shockwave, and I had to think about it for a while. And so I think this was your homework. So I am going to leave my lecture notes. They have a lot of calculations in them, which if you are interested in anything, I think they are readable. And I'm going to leave you all my slides, if you're interested in anything. I enjoyed teaching this. I enjoyed, for the first time, having my algebra corrected. And thank you very much.